In the upper chamber where Jesus and his disciples assembled to eat the Passover, there occurred two dramas which have tremendous significance for all Christians. One was the betrayal of Jesus by Judas Iscariot, and the other consisted in the giving by Jesus to his disciples the new commandment. The Passover was one of the greatest of the feasts of the Jews, and so remains among all who observe it and the Hebraic laws. Jesus well knew its significance historically and its social value, as well as he did its religious import. In that room was to be instituted a ceremony which would supplant the Passover for his followers, and afterwards was to be enacted the sacrifice which would forever sublimate the Passover. The Lord's Supper became a preparation for Gethsemane and Calvary, which followed. We have noted his lesson of service, exemplified by washing the feet of his apostles. After they had eaten the Passover, he blessed bread and gave it to them to eat, as emblematic of his body broken for them, and wine as emblematic of his shed blood. This was the first Lord's Supper, superseding among all Christians the feast of the Passover, and the Lord's Supper continues to be celebrated as one of the sacraments. Among us of the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it constitutes each time, if properly partaken of, a renewal of the covenant made in the waters of baptism, a promise to obey the Christian mandates. Who of us can sense the deep grief of Jesus when Judas Iscariot left the upper chamber on his trip of betrayal? The record of the happenings in the room makes no mention of his sorrow, except perhaps a faint indication of it. But as Jesus knew beforehand who would betray him, and the time, he probably had suffered in anticipation and had conquered the outward manifestations of his keen grief. But who can doubt that this was one of the factors which later impelled him to seek Gethsemane and plead for the passing of the cruel cup? The betrayal by Judas of his master is a grim commentary on the fact that agency is ultimate. It cannot be doubted that Jesus knew who was to betray him, and he appears to have made one last desperate appeal to Judas when he selected the bread and dipped it into the wine and gave it to him. The scriptures record that immediately after the sop, Satan entered into him. Jesus, however, who knew what was to take place, not only kept silence, but protected Judas with the words, "That thou doest, do quickly." We do not know whether Peter had his sword with him in the chamber, but he certainly had it with him in the Garden of Gethsemane. What might have happened had Peter known the intention of Judas to betray the Master? So Judas passed out into the night with the protection of the Master. We are not watching here the dealings of one man with another. We are looking at the way in which God deals with men. If a man will betray the Son of God, then the heavenly mandate is, so be it. God is made to serve with their sins, according to the tremendous words of Isaiah. But even more than this, this is the way the kingdom of God meets the sin of the world. God takes the worst that wicked men and nations can do, suffers their violence, and yet, in the end, turns their tragic sin to a revelation of his own glory, such as was manifest upon the cross. There has been almost endless debate upon the fate or the ultimate condition of the soul of Judas. We do know that he was overcome with remorse. The motives of Judas and the possible reason for his conduct are beyond the scope of this talk. But the tremendous and all-encompassing truth is that agency, or the power of choice, is a gift of God vouchsafed in our creation, and God himself is subject to it. He dare not violate the law of man's own being. He is limited in his capacity to bless and redeem us by the fact that we have agency, and that this gift of God to us has imposed limitations on him which he himself has ordained. There is no doubt that Christ could have restrained Judas. The fact that he did not speaks volumes about God and man and their relation, the one to the other. Love may make its appeal to us. It does so in a myriad number of ways, most of all in the vision of that august and awe-inspiring symbol of the divine supremacy, the dreadful yet beauteous solitude of the Master upon the cross. And yet we may, and often do, refuse love's appeal. Love and its attendant sacrifice is the only known relationship or procedure in the universe that will change a man's will and yet conserve his freedom. For it is in the acts of sacrifice, in which what we want is renounced for the sake of someone loved, that we are most conscious of being supremely free. After Jesus had in anger left the room, there occurred one of the most important events which transpired in that room, now matchless in its historic importance. Turning to his disciples, he addressed them as little children, saying that he would be with them yet a little while, that he would go where they could not come. He addressed them as children, for even after their years of experience with him, sitting under his instruction, how little they knew of the kingdom he came to establish. Would they learn in due time? It is certain that after he left, they would have experience in abundance. But now, what of now? Well, he could leave them further instruction. But would they remember? Perhaps if he gave them something so simple and basic that they could not forget, it would form a basis from which they could not forget. It would form a basis from which they could analyze problems of conduct. And so he said, "A new commandment give I unto you, that ye love one another, as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another." In his answer to the lawyer, Jesus had given the first and second great commandment as love God and love neighbor as self, and had said these were so basic as to form that upon which all the law and the prophets could be hung. Now in this upper chamber, he reduced the law to a single command, love one another. What do you think? If all had this love in heart, would we have need for law? Would there be social evils and sins? How far have you gone in developing this great law as a dynamic in your life? How did this new commandment impress itself upon the disciples? Who knows? It is said that John the Beloved lived to be a very old man. Legend has it that as he lay dying, he raised up and said, "Little children, love one another." It had impressed him deeply. There is no doubt that he had all his life taught it, and as his spirit was about to leave his body, he called out what he had come to know was the foundation of all Christian commandments.